You know, when you are out on the trail and things go right, where you have your nutrition dialed in, you have your training plan has been dialed in, you feel fit and you feel prepared for
right,
a race.
Right.
There's nothing better than that happiness at the start line.
Yeah, that happiness.
Similar to that, Health IQ is a partner of ours. If you go to healthiq.com/TRN, they will connect you with life insurance that is from A-rated life insurance providers for healthy people. And there's something about that that helps you relax knowing that you are insured in case something happens.
Our tribe of people are in shape, Scott. They're not sitting on couches, eating a bunch of bonbons, slugging down a bunch of soda pop. They're climbing hills. And
which means they demand and deserve better rates on their life insurance.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, Health IQ, we usually do a quiz. They
we
send
do.
Out
and
a quiz.
Today's quiz is called Running, Training to Increase Speed.
Now, Scott, I just want to ask, how come I'm always the recipient of the quiz and you're always the giver of the quiz?
Because you don't know what website to go to.
Okay.
It's healthiq.com/TRN. Here's the quiz.
All right, ready.
Question, running schedules with built-in rest or off days can include building muscles needed for optimal speed by doing what? A, not running for a week. B, cross training. C, leg day and arm day. Or D, only resting every 2 weeks.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to just go with cross training because it just seemed like the best answer.
I think you are correct.
Good. Okay, one for one. We're doing three of them. Let's go.
For optimal speed while running long distance, it's important to fuel right.
Yes, absolutely.
What kind of food is a good pre-run or mid-run snack?
All right.
A, better to eat nothing before.
Nope, I don't think so.
B, bagel with peanut butter.
Yeah, it's good.
C, eggs and bacon. Or D, ice cream. This is going to be an interesting
one. That's a good one because I think they're all right answers. It depends on the body, but I'm going to go...
eggs and bacon?
Yeah, eggs and bacon. Why
eggs
not?
And bacon? Let's see what... bagel with peanut butter is what they came
up
with.
You
so
know
we
what?
Can we can argue that. Okay, here we go. And the last question. I swear this is the last question. Warm-ups are a vital part of both practice and race day because they
Absolutely.
Prevent injury
yes.
and improve performance by doing what? A, decrease blood flow or core
no.
temperature.
No, no.
B, strengthening muscles.
Nah, it's too late to strengthen pre-race.
C, hydrating the muscles.
Mm.
Or D, increase blood flow core temperature.
Oh, it's increased blood flow core temperature. Easy.
Warm-ups promote good performance and decrease injury by getting the blood flowing faster to the muscles with a rise in body temperature and lubricating the joints. Go to healthiq.com/TRN. If you downloaded this podcast the moment it was released, that's the weekend that the Under Armour Mountain Running Series is in Killington, Vermont.
Killington, Vermont. Isn't that a place where they do a lot of ski?
It's a
ski
resort. Yep. And this race is aptly named the Appalachians in Killington, Vermont. Starts on the 18th of August and goes through the 20th. And you're probably asking yourself, Don, why does it take so many days?
Yeah, why does it?
Well, it's because there's different races. There's seven different race distances, in fact, from 5K 10K, half marathon. There's a vertical challenge. There's a marathon relay. There's a marathon. And there's also a 50K. So there's something for everyone. It is a festival of running in the mountains.
A gathering of the tribe, if you will.
Yeah. Now, if you happen to download this podcast and you weren't quite able to get registered for the race, guess what?
What?
There's another one.
Where would
the
that be?
The final of the three running series is going to be held in Copper Mountain, Colorado, called Rocky Mountains on September 8th through the 10th. Again, they have seven different running distances.
And plenty of time to get ready for them.
I bet you there's going to be some music. There's going to be some eats. There's going to be a lot of fun and frivolity.
There's frivolity?
Yep.
I don't know if that's allowed there.
So if you go to uamountainrunning.com You can see more information, and if you want to register and get a discount as a Nation member, you can enter the code TRNATION, get 20% off your registration fee. I was down in the Central Valley of California, the breadbasket of the world. If you're not from California or know about the breadbasket, that's where most crops for the nation and for the world are grown.
Is it called the breadbasket, Scott? I thought that was the Midwest, is some of the breadbasket.
Well, it depends on who you're talking to.
I think it's a fruit basket.
Or nut basket. I don't know.
I don't know what it is.
There's a lot of nuts down there, and there's a lot of fruit. But my point is I'm down there, I'm in the rural town, and I pull up to one of my customers, and out comes this kid, and he has a pair of Aftershocks Trex Titanium blue, the same color I have, around his neck.
Maybe they were yours.
And I look at, you know, I'm missing mine. Anyway, I look at him, I go, hey, those are Trex Titaniums. And he got this big smile on his face. And he goes, yeah, I love these. These are the best headphones ever. I go, are you a runner? And he goes, no. I said, how do you find out about it? He goes, you know, I don't know how I found out about them, but it was a year and a half ago. He's had them for a year and a half. And he says, I work construction. And he says, these are the best headphones because they're out of my way. There's no wires. I can still hear people talk to me. I can be safe on the in the work environment. And I can listen to my tunes. And I thought, you know what? It's not just for runners. Trex Titanium is for everyone. Thanks for your input, by the way.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, no problem. When did you want me to interject?
I was just waiting. I was looking at your eyes.
I was
waiting for a question.
I kind of identified they might have been that your headphones. Wasn't that a good question?
That was a good question.
So where do people go to get these, Scott?
Are you going to keep that?
I'm keeping all of it. This is edit-free.
If they go to our partner page at Trail Runner Nation, click on the partner page. There's a link there that will take you over. And it will explain how, if you order a pair of these headphones, you can get a free Trail Runner Nation buff.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast. With me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio, it's Scott and Dom.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will the group of the nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr, and we have a fun podcast ahead of us today. We have our three coaches. We call them, quote-unquote, our three coaches because that's the way we introduced them on our last podcast.
And they're coaching our brains, too. These are the smartest guys we could round up off the trail.
They are. We have Ian Sharman, Joe Yuhan, and Matt Lay. Thanks, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we want to...
That's the intro, Scott?
No.
Oh, you got more?
I have paragraphs.
Oh, good. Because you were tasked with intro.
I have good stuff.
All right. Okay, go ahead.
You just got to give me time.
All right. You got to warm up.
Calm down. Pace yourself, pal.
Okay. Sorry.
So Ian Sharman, just recently at Western States 100 in 2017, finished seventh place in a very, very heated competitive battle out there. That was a rough race this year.
Yes, it was.
And he's also just on the road from in Colorado getting prepared for the Leadville 100 coming up here this month. He is the main coach at Sharman Ultra Endurance Coaching at SharmanUltra.com, where you can get coaching, nutrition, and stride analysis information.
Fantastic.
Ian, tell us something about you that we don't know.
That's always a difficult question. I would say...
Don't say you're from England.
Well, everyone can tell that. Well, actually, people can't tell that when I speak. They think I'm Australian for some reason. But I know. I like road running as much as trail running. How's that?
That's fine.
I'm probably more associated as a trail runner, but I love mixing them both up.
Hmm. Okay. And our second coach of the three is Joe Juhan. This year he competed at the very competitive Lake Sonoma 50 and finished very high in the ranking at 13th. Last year, last fall, he was second place at the Superior Falls Trail Race. That's 100 mile. You can find him at Juhan Performance, where you can also hire him as a coach and get some stride analysis and nutrition. You can also see him. He's a regular contributor at Ultra Running Magazine, mm-hmm. which is our favorite periodical.
Yes, it
on
is.
Our coffee table. Joe, tell us something we don't know about you.
Ooh, how about I've got a really bad stride.
Oh.
People?
But we can edit that out if you don't want to.
I think the important thing is you recognize some of the faults in your stride, where many of us just run blindly without knowing that. So hats off to you, sir, for acknowledging your stride.
See, the reason that I'm partnering with Charmin Ultra is that Ian has such a beautiful stride that, you know, he's maybe a little bit less versed in all of the problems you could possibly have. Whereas I have all of these problems, or have had all these problems. And as I like to tell my clients, I completely forget how to run about every 4 to 6 months. So it's highly instructive. But yeah, people think, you know, I'm a physical therapist. I know a lot about running injury and do running stride analysis. So I must have this perfect, wonderful stride. And unfortunately, it can be good at times, but it's fleeting.
Hey Ian, I'm going to have to play that back and listen closely. Was that a compliment or not to you? I'm not sure. I'll run it back.
That was a compliment. I'll take that.
A thumbs up for Ian, and I'm kind of impartial.
I will say, too, that I finally met Joe face-to-face, not this virtual stuff, at Western States, where he was living in a van.
Perfect.
He has a very cool Juhan Performance van, and I saw him stop by and talk to him while he was having lunch inside his living quarters.
Cool. Next up,
we have Matt Lay. He's an assistant professor in health and human performance at the College of Idaho, also a frequent contributor at Ultra Running Magazine. Matt, what don't we know that we should know about you?
Let's see. I just had microfracture surgery, so I'll be laid up for a few weeks and probably not running for a few months. And who knows what the competitive side of my running holds going forward.
Can you explain that a little bit? I am a man that is very familiar with knee injuries being rebuilt with two ACLs, new ACLs. Mm. What is microfracture surgery, and why did you have to have it done?
So a couple years ago, I took a pretty hard fall on my knee, and I think during that fall, I had done some damage to the underlying bone, and as a consequence, some of the cartilage had sort of just disintegrated or died after a period of time, and it left me with a bone-on-bone sort of at my femur and tibia. And so that bone-on-bone had been bothering me for a couple years, and tried to take a conservative approach, and eventually decided on this surgery called microfracture, which is a fairly old surgery. And basically they go in and they make little holes in my femur. And that allows the bone marrow to sort of come through those holes, and it forms a clot right over that section of the bone where there's no cartilage. And that bone marrow then stimulates sort of stem cell development and lays down new cartilage. At least that's the goal. Mm. So hopefully in 6 to 9 months, I'll have some new cartilage there that will allow me not to have that bone-on-bone sort of inflammation that I was getting before.
Oh, interesting.
Good. Well, this is a podcast.
And guys, I was just at his house a couple of days ago driving through, and he showed me all the photos of inside his knee. So pretty gruesome looking, but it hopefully will help him there. But yeah, luckily it was after we ate rather than before.
Good.
Well, this podcast is our thumbs up, thumbs down podcast. It's the second one that we've done, and we had so much fun last time. We thought, let's bring on the three coaches and do it again.
Yep.
And explain the way this works.
Well,
Freeman.
You know, we all have opinions on something, and sometimes they're not based on real true facts. And so we're bringing in three fact finders, fact distributors. Let me start over. Thumbs up means you like the concept and the principle. You're all for it.
Uh-huh.
thumbs in the middle means I really don't have an opinion yet, and thumbs down means I'm against what was about to be stated. We have a few topics. Scott has them listed out here.
I do.
We'll run with them. Each one of the coaches will hear the topic. They'll say thumbs up or thumbs down, their opinion, and then they'll discuss it. And after the discussion, we'll see if any thumbs up or down changed.
And as a rule, Don and I start with a non-biased opinion.
Yes, we're not committed because we really don't know anything.
And we're the hosts. And we can make up the rules.
And then after we see how everybody votes and what sounds the smartest, then we get to vote and look like we know what we're talking about.
Right.
That's the deal.
Okay.
So what's the first one, Scott?
Topic number one is a topic that has been in Ultra Running Magazine. We've had as a topic on our podcast. I'm sure there's lots of stuff out there. It is NSAIDs. NSAIDs. What does that stand for?
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So
wow.
Your ibuprofen or Motrin has been kind of tabooed as you come across aid station tables. We want to get to the down and dirty of that with guys that know.
So, Joe, before our discussion, what do you think about NSAIDs? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Ian?
Thumbs down.
Mm. And Matt?
Thumbs down.
But it's going to be a short discussion. Maybe we should start off with why are they so bad? And let's distinguish between acetaminophen, Tylenol, and the ibuprofen. Are they in the same category? But why such bad stuff with ibuprofen?
Is aspirin an NSAID?
It's in the NSAID category.
No. Okay.
So.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. It's not in the NSAID
that's
category.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, you know, that's why we have the experts here. I will not edit that out. Okay, who wants to start with why NSAIDs are so bad?
Maybe we should start with why people take them to begin with.
Mm.
I've never been a fan of them, but I think if you ask the runners who take them, it's not necessarily because they have an acute injury. There's something, it's like this combination of pain reliever, a certain type of pain relief that they get from taking ibuprofen, but it's clearly based on what I've heard from athletes that there's either a training or a performance enhancement to them, and that's where the problem becomes, because it's not. I think the issue isn't you take a couple and then you have the serious issue. It's people that in the course of a 24-hour run or a 100-miler are taking them an anti-inflammatory dose, which could be 4 to 12 of them every 4 hours. So that's what then creates this issue. So I don't know what the other guys have heard as to what those motivations are, but it'd be interesting to hear what they have to say.
You know, I'm just going to chime in here. When I first started running a few years ago, I heard it referred to for the first time as vitamin I. and I got to the point where I would take an ibuprofen before I went out to run.
Exactly.
Because I was thinking, you know, this will keep the inflammation down, which will help me recover and stuff like that. And since then, I've learned a little bit more. But is ibuprofen as bad as acetaminophen? Or aspirin?
If you're looking at the effects, so I think one of the major reasons it's a thumbs down is because it has some strong effects on kidney function.
Okay.
And most ultra runners, like just completing an ultra marathon, there's some data that points to about 40% of people who finish have what you would consider clinical kidney damage. Not necessarily going into rhabdo, but just the beginning signs of kidney damage, as is, I mean, ultramarathons are super stressful on the body, so it's not surprising that that sort of damage occurs. But then you throw on top of it something like an NSAID that can exaggerate that kidney sort of dysfunction, and that can lead to some serious health issues. So I think that there is a difference between the NSAIDs and acetaminophen in terms of kidney function. So
when Joe was stating there are some issues taking it, that's really the issues you're reporting at, Joe. It is the stress on the kidney.
Correct. My understanding is that and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but it's a COX-1 inhibitor, which means that it's a certain part of the cell that inhibits an inflammation response, and what that drug also does is it is a vasoconstrictor to the blood vessels of the kidney. So you already have that to begin with, where the body's like, let's not shuttle a lot of blood to the kidneys during this hard run. Well, then you kind of double that up with the effect of the COX-1 inhibitor, which, to my understanding, ibuprofen is one of those and acetaminophen is not.
Yeah, exactly.
You have this huge loss of blood flow, and that's what's messing the kidney up in these studies.
Yep.
And one thing that's important to point out is that whenever you do a long run, you get some muscle breakdown. And particularly if you're doing an ultra, and especially 100 miles, then there's quite a lot of muscle damage. And so when they've checked the CPK levels of people after 100 milers, the normal range is somewhere between up to about 200. I'm not sure if it's parts per something or whatever, but on the range that's used for that, up to about 200. And you can get up to 200,000 after races like Western States. In fact, over 200,000 has been reported. And to give you some context, my blood was tested after Western States, and I had a level of 11,000. So compared to a baseline of like 100, 11,000 is, you know, most doctors would look at that if they're not familiar with runners and go, wow, you have got some serious rhabdo going on. Your muscle breakdown is very severe. You're in trouble. And that in itself is not actually that much of an issue. It's the fact that the muscle breakdown is then in the blood, and then it can kind of clog up the kidneys, especially if they're not functioning as well with the, and this can happen with or without NSAIDs, but NSAIDs just increases the risk of it.
You know, we've heard this term rhabdo a couple times. What is rhabdo?
It's essentially an excessive breakdown of muscle protein that then causes, that can then cause kidney failure.
Okay. And at that time, running an ultra, we're already putting a huge demand on our body, and then to lessen its ability to adapt and accommodate to these stresses, we load it with ibuprofen or Motrin, and that even raises risk higher. So I can see needing to stay away from that. You need your body to work well out there. You don't need to sabotage it.
So is acetaminophen, you said that it does not have the same effect on the kidneys. Is acetaminophen okay?
To me, this goes to the second point where I'm sort of thumbs down on the NSAIDs, and that's because it's a pharmacological agent that inhibits pain. And to me, that's a performance enhancer. Mm. So sort of from the ethical standpoint of, are we taking drugs that enhance our performance? I would say acetaminophen is then also not okay. I mean, we don't.
And this is a fine line here, because obviously these are not banned substances. So if someone tests positive for having it, they're not in any trouble. And so it's how, you know, where is the line drawn? And the line in this case is drawn that it's okay to take these. But I kind of agree with Matt that it seems kind of wrong to take a drug to enhance your performance. But in addition to that, it's not just about the performance enhancement element of it. It's that if I'm in a 100 miler and something hurts, that is a valid signal that I want to listen to. So I make sure that I don't damage myself a lot more. So whether it's helping performance or not, I think there's the danger element out there, not just of kidney failure, but also of potentially causing more serious damage to yourself because you keep running through what could potentially be an injury that you make a lot worse. And, you know, if you want to finish a 100 miler at all cost, maybe that's something you're willing to do. If you want, you know, if you don't want to be in a wheelchair for 6 months afterwards, not that that's a likely scenario, but it's more likely if you're blocking out those pain signals.
Would there, in your opinion, would there be any situation running a 50 or 100 mile distance where you would be okay advising someone or yourself taking any kind of NSAID, including aspirin?
I wouldn't personally, generally, but it seems like the fine line that, as Joe mentioned, it's more about taking lots of these pills during a race. If you just take a couple of ibuprofen, it probably won't have an effect. I mean, there's not a high risk if you just have that small amount of it. But also, if you're doing a race that lasts 24 plus hours, people are more likely to keep taking them because maybe the effect wears off, so they take some more, then they take some more. And that's more where the risk is. So I actually had a bit of pushback when I posted an article about this that was published recently on Twitter. And Dave Mackey in particular and Pam Smith so Pam Smith, who's a doctor, and Dave Mackey, who works in the medical field as well. And they said they tended to use ibuprofen, but not in large quantities. And so they were very keen to point out, if you just take a little bit of it, it's not a huge risk. But also, these are people who can finish their races quicker than the average person. So they wouldn't need to take it for as long as someone who's going to be out there for 30 hours or so.
Good, good. Are we ready to round up our thumbs?
Well, before we do the thumbs thing, I have a question for you, Don.
Okay.
There's a small race that you're going to be participating in this weekend.
Yes.
Called the Bigfoot 200 Mile.
Yeah.
Do you have in your drop bag and in your bag that you're packing, do you have any NSAIDs?
Not yet. And and I don't think any will go in.
After this discussion.
Yeah, guys, I'm going to be out there for, 70, 80 plus hours. So, I need kidneys the whole way. I don't want to shut them down halfway.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
And you need the kidneys afterwards.
Yes, that's true. Joe.
Just one more component to this, and it may apply to some later discussions. It's an individual choice, so I don't think there's any of the three of us who as coaches or professionals would say, oh, yeah, do this. But the bigger issue is going to be chronic use, and not necessarily like over the course of a race, but to say, to have then a mindset or a narrative that this is a good thing for me to do. And there's a belief system amongst athletes that inflammation is bad. And it's always bad, and we always have to get rid of it. But the reality is inflammation is healing. So if you are chronically taking ibuprofen, okay, so fine, you don't take 30 of them during a 100-miler, but you're taking 8 of them a day, every single day, you may be actually impeding your recovery process or an injury healing process, let alone some other systemic things that we don't even know about. So that applies to anything that, or any kind of mindset where you're just vehemently fighting against inflammation. There should be a recognition that inflammation is a normal healing process. And in rare circumstances, our body will overdo inflammation, but otherwise we kind of need to let it run its course.
Good, good. And before we gather the thumbs up, I just want to point out that, and guys, correct me if I'm wrong, because so far I've been wrong on almost every statement that I made that has any clinical relevance.
You said the correct acronym for NSAIDs.
Yeah, I got that right.
Yeah, I just want to give you a pat on the back.
I need it when I can. Now, acetaminophen, Tylenol, is tougher on the liver than the kidneys. And science is always a little bit behind in a lot of things. We haven't discovered how important our liver is in some of these processes out there. And guys like Marty Hoffman, that's a medical director and works on some of these things, will discover soon that, hey, we shouldn't be taking this either. So I'm with the coaches here. I think you're better off hands off figuring out why you're in pain, and then just respecting the body and realizing there's no free lunch out there. You take something to make something go away, you're trading off for something else, and that something else is probably something we need to get us down to the finish line. So I'm going to weigh in first on a thumbs down.
Clearly
a thumbs down based on my education with these coaches.
Any changes from the coaches? Any wavering of the thumbs down?
Nope.
No, but just to add to that, I would say that just a good general thing in life is if you don't need to take medication, think of all the adverts you see on TV where they say they spend half the advert telling you all the downsides. And we don't even necessarily know the downsides there of taking the Tylenol type things as well. So better not to take them if you don't have to. And ultimately, it's too much of a risk, and it's better to be able to judge pain yourself. And if pain's getting really serious, maybe there's a serious injury in there you need to be paying attention to.
Scott, your thumb is up or down?
My thumb is down. Good. I have gone way away from calling it vitamin I. It is not a Flintstones chewable. No.
It is not.
So I don't even carry ibuprofen in my little water bottle holder anymore.
What's up next, Scott?
All right. Let's see. Where do we want to? Let's do this one because it's a fun thing to say. Whoop. Thumbs up or thumbs down on whoop?
What?
Not whoopee, Don. Whoop.
Oh, then let me change my thumb. let me remove my thumb.
There is a company, and I think Joe may have more information on this, but there's a company called Whoop, W-H-O-O-P, that has created a device that can track recovery.
Tell us about that, Joe. You know a little bit about it?
Do we want to see if...
Oh, we want a thumbs up down it?
Yeah, let's thumbs up down it without any information.
Maybe I'll introduce it just a little bit. And then
very good.
And you can get some first impressions. So I'm not affiliated with them. I have not gotten a free one. I'm not sponsored by them at all. It's just been something that one of my athletes brought to my attention. And now I have... at least three of them using it. It is a wearable technology that tracks several biometrics, including heart rate variability, skin temperature, heart rate during exercise, and even things like sleep quantity and sleep quality. So unlike almost anything else out there right now, it is this kind of round-the-clock biometric that not only gives you a measure of how hard your workout is, it's actually giving you a measure of, or what they call a strain score, for how hard your day was. So, and which then includes the non-running components of your day. And then they are able to calculate recovery then based on how well you sleep and elements such as heart rate variability. So it's one of these newer things out there, and it's a very interesting idea.
And as a little addition to that, we've talked on the podcast a number of times, recovery is where you gain performance increases. It's not the breaking down of the muscles when you exercise. It is the recovery after, where your muscles repair and become stronger, and that's when you build your endurance and performance. So. I'm gonna throw in.
You're not a thumbs up or down.
We're
impartial. Let's get the coaches.
Yeah.
Coaches, Ian, what do you say? Why don't you start off with your thumb, and then we'll go around the horn to Matt, and then to Joe.
I would say a tentative thumbs up because I'm only familiar with it from having researched it because you guys mentioned it for the podcast. But in principle, thumbs up.
Okay, Matt.
Yeah, I'm sort of a thumbs in the middle as well. I'm sort of undecided at the moment, exactly where I stand on it.
Good. And then, Joe, you've had quite a bit of experience, more than the rest of us. Where's your thumb?
Thumbs up.
Okay. So I'm reading on the website. It says that it can personalize your recovery. Recovery determines how much strain there is. It talks about your sleep that you need. And then it makes some claims that people that are using this increase the number of or increase their sleep time. They increase their heart rate variability. Their heart rate, their resting heart rate is lowered because of this technology, or at least because of they're able to track and maybe be motivated by this technology. What else do you know about it, Joe?
You said that pretty well in terms of summing up. And I think where the utility comes from and is the quantification, or at least the attempt to quantify holistic stress. So in other words, not just your workout, but your work day and your family day and so on. And then the amount of rest and recovery that you have accumulated via sleep. But then what's the physiological state of recovery using heart rate variability? And if the listeners aren't really aware what heart rate variability is, to my understanding, it is, there are basically two sets of controls for our heart rate. There is a local control in the heart, and then there's kind of a systemic control through the vagus nerve, when that's the autonomic nervous system. That's kind of our rest and regeneration part of the nervous system. So the idea is when we are totally rested and essentially the nervous system is satisfied with where we're at, there will be significant heart rate variability because the heart's just doing its own thing. It beats when it wants to beat, and it'll kind of have this micro variation between the duration of one beat to the other. And it's a very minute amount. It's not like an irregular beat by any means. It's just very small differences in that beat. However, when there's significant fatigue in the system, the autonomic nervous system will override the local control and say, no, okay, you need to beat this at this exact rate because we need the system to recover, in theory. So the heart rate variability, therefore, will go down if the vagus nerve is controlling it. So heart rate variability is one of the newest kind of metrics for recovery, because it's if heart rate in general is the best metric for stress while we do a workout, then heart rate variability right now may be the best metric for how the entire system, including the nervous system, is recovered.
You know, and I want to throw in one of the claims that they make on the Whoop website says, after 4 months, Whoop athletes increase their heart rate variability by 8 milliseconds. Matt, can you explain, in addition to what Joe said, a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think it's good to sort of an example of what heart rate variability means. Now, what 8 milliseconds means, I have no idea, honestly.
But sounds really good.
It sounds amazing. But, so, for example, if your heart rate is 60, if you had a low heart rate variability, basically every second, so if your heart rate was 60 beats a minute, every second there'd be a heartbeat. Now, if your heart rate had a lot of variability, over that same 1 minute, you'd still have 60 heartbeats. Let's say one was 0.8 seconds, one was 0.2 1.2 seconds, etc. But over that minute, you would still have 60 heartbeats. So that's what the difference between a variable, highly variable, and a non-variable heart rate is.
So high, explain, maybe I'm, so, hopefully I understand so, this. High heart rate variability where there's big gaps between is better than low?
Yes, because what that means is that you're not under sympathetic stress. All right, so we have two branches of the autonomic nervous system, the parasympathetic, which is our rest and digest, and the sympathetic, which is our fight or flight. When the sympathetic is sort of the dominant, we have less variability in our heart rate, And that means we're more stressed and we're less recovered. And they've shown that after a really hard workout, that you have less heart rate variability in response to that workout. So that's the sort of the theory behind the idea of why heart rate variability is important to measure and why it can be sort of a marker of how recovered you are, at least at the nervous system level, and how prepared you would be to do your next sort of hard effort.
That's kind of counterintuitive. If you were to give me a multiple choice test on heart rate variability, I would have thought that if you have a more rhythmic heartbeat, that would be better. So a lower heart rate variability, it would have been better. So I learned something today.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't vote until after we're done, Scott.
So as an example, when you breathe in, your parasympathetic branch of the nervous system gets activated. And when you breathe out, your sympathetic branch of the nervous system gets activated. So if you looked at your heart rate breathing in and breathing out, you'd see that you got slightly slower heart rate when you breathe in and slightly faster heart rate when you breathe out. And that would indicate that you have high heart rate variability. But when you're stressed, that difference between the breathing out and breathing in wouldn't be as prevalent.
Good. So there's some other claims on the Whoop website, and two of them I want to call a little bit of BS on. I mean, it's probably true, but I don't think you need a wearable to tell you this. One of them says that after 4 months, a typical Whoop athlete consumes 79% increased their sleep per night by 41 minutes. So I think you can maybe just set your little Timex alarm and just say, hey, it's time to go to bed.
I think clearly once anything you measure improves. And so you start being aware that you're only sleeping 6 hours a night. You say, well, that's not right. I'll sleep more. So I think measuring is good. Your alcohol comment, I'm not so sure.
Well, so, my interpretation of that isn't that the Whoop is causing that. It's that people like myself who tend to struggle with sleep quality and sleep quantity, and you keep seeing these bad numbers come up on your recovery score, I think you're going to be more motivated to say, oh, well, I have this metric that says I'm not sleeping nearly enough and this isn't going nearly as well. And I think you're more motivated to get to bed a little bit earlier, to have a little bit less alcohol before sleep. And that's the idea. That's the idea that behind this device that I like so much. I don't know it necessarily if it's 100% accurate or if it's going to deliver on all of its claims. But anything that for me and for my clientele that's going to increase awareness that what they do as non-runners impacts their running, I'm all for that. There, you know, anything that will illuminate that we don't have two separate vessels, we don't have our life in one bucket and then running in another. They are one finite unit, and then it's robbing Peter to pay Paul to do this great run in the morning and then have four beers and stay up an hour late that night, it may be a total wash, and I think that surprises a lot of athletes.
No, I agree. That holistic approach is something that is key to training in general. That's one of the first things I tell people when I start coaching them, is that it's not just how hard your training workouts are, it's how hard everything in life is. If you're having a stressful week, if you've got a big presentation, all of that's going to have a big effect. So the thing I like about this in principle is that it's at least making you aware of that. I think there's probably a lot of variability between one person and another for, you know, I saw on their website, they'd say an example of this guy, he had a certain workout. Now he needs to have 8 hours, 41 minutes of sleep. Firstly, you don't fall asleep within 1 second anyway. And secondly, two people in who've done exactly the same workout, have the same metrics on their device, you know, they probably don't need exactly the same number of hours of sleep. So it probably needs some pretty smart artificial intelligence so that it learns about yourself and how to tailor that to you better. But in principle, it's like Joe said, it's just making you aware of it, and measuring things makes you better. If every time I drink a beer, I have to write it down, it reminds me that I don't need to have as many beers. So it's going to make that easier. One of the biggest benefits of having a coach is the fact that people are being monitored. I get so many people after a few months, they say, you know, it's great. It's just being accountable, having certain things to do. And I know I have to do them, or I have to explain why not. Same kind of principle here, that just being aware of things. And whenever your little bad habits, like going to bed too late, are being highlighted and thrown in your face the whole time, you tend to change it. So I could totally imagine that it would lower some of those negatives. Plus, anyone who's going to spend $500 to get this device is probably committed enough to say, I'm going to use the information from this to act on it. So I think in those ways, it can be very useful. You could probably do a lot of it without a device like this, but it's just kind of keeping you honest the whole time. So I do like that element. I just imagine that there's probably a lot of variability from one person to another. That means that their exact prescriptions may not be spot on, but they're still going to probably be in the ballpark and better than what you might have done by default.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Ian. I think if we took a survey of your clients before they picked up with you as coaches, we would find all kinds of changes in these metrics we're trying to measure. I mean, how much better the recovery is, or how much more sleep you're getting, or diets change. The accountability factor. Take that $500 that you're going to spend on that device and send it to one of these coaches, and you'll end up with better results.
Sounds like a great
public service announcement.
All right, let's keep track of our thumbs. Where are they at, guys?
Thumbs
let's
up.
Let's go. Let's start with
thumbs up.
Ian's thumb up. Joe's a thumbs up. What about you, Matt? You didn't say much.
You were kind of on the fence.
Yeah, I think I'm still a thumbs in the middle, just because I've looked at some of the nitty gritty science behind it, and I'm not sure that the algorithms are going to be super predictive of whether you need like a Whoop recovery device or whether just the heart rate variability itself is sufficient. I mean, so I'm sort of somewhere in the middle, waiting for some more detailed studies specific with their device, at least some randomized studies rather than their study that they sort of highlight on their website to be done. So
that is also my caveat.
I think Matt invented, was the originator of thumbs in the middle.
We'll
I think,
have to go back to that original podcast.
We said we could have thumbs up or thumbs down, and he came in with thumbs neutral.
He's a good professor.
he's scientifically minded.
What's yours?
Mine is, well, now that I've heard all this, you know.
You can't say it depends, Freeman. You got to make a thumbs up or
thumbs up. I'm going thumbs up.
Well, I'm going to go against the grain here.
Good.
I'm going to go thumbs down, and here's the reason why. First of all, it's $500. The watch that I have currently, it tracks my sleep.
Hmm.
So I have that. Number two, I don't drink alcohol. I got that one taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
My heart rate variability, I honestly don't see how tracking that's going to make me a better runner. So there's three of the five metrics that they say this will help you with. So I'm going thumbs down.
All right, good. All right, next topic, Scott.
Here's one that we have not talked about. I don't think we've talked about this at all on the podcast before, and I have actually no opinion about it. I know people that are very into this and people that aren't, and that is cryotherapy.
Hmm.
Do you know what cryotherapy is, Freeman?
I certainly do.
What is it?
Step into a very cold room. I will have to get from the experts the exact temperature. It's cold.
Colder than an ice bath?
And they time you. It's much colder than an ice bath, and they time you and make sure that you're... safe in there, and then have you exit. There's localized cryotherapy too, where they can blow some cold air on you. But cryotherapy has a pretty broad-based definition because putting a set of peas, cold peas on your quadricep could be cryotherapy by definition. Guys, straighten me out since I've said some things against the grain every chance I can. Help me see the places I'm wrong. Who wants to lead with this?
Do we want to do thumbs up, thumbs down?
Oh, yeah.
We know what it is.
Okay.
So Freeman, you can't vote. Ian, what's yours? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
I'm going to say a thumbs down for especially the really cold element of it.
Okay.
Matt?
Yeah, I'm thumbs down.
Ooh.
Oh, Joe?
Thumbs down.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay.
I am surprised by that.
Yes.
I really am surprised.
I thought we'd have at least one thumbs up.
Let's
not even a thumbs neutral.
Let's talk about that. We have here in the Sacramento area a place that does cryotherapy for athletes, and I see people posting stuff on Facebook all the time where they go in there with their, you know, it's 106 degrees outside, and you see a picture of them with a knit cap and their mittens on.
So who can give us a better definition than I did? Certainly, it'll be not a high bar to get across of what cryotherapy is.
So it's Matt? essentially like a ice, like an ice bath on steroids. I mean, it's negative 19 degrees Celsius, from what I understand, sort of the definitions are. And it can be whole body or more specific for certain body parts. But instead of, say, an ice bath, like maybe you're in there for 10, 15 minutes, this could be just a few minutes of this ultra low temperature therapy. And I guess the theory behind it is, again, it reduces inflammation and helps sort of stop the detrimental metabolic processes that are occurring in the body. But I haven't seen that much evidence in favor of it. So,
and for us that are not academic like Matt Lay, he was using the Celsius degrees. For us in the U.S. that are still working on the Fahrenheit, he said 140 degrees, negative 140 degrees Celsius. That's a negative 220 Fahrenheit.
Hmm.
I lived in Wyoming. It never got that cold in Wyoming. That's pretty darn cold.
It gets that cold in Minnesota, though. Okay, so any opinions from Joe or Ian on the cryotherapy and getting into conditions that extreme?
Well, I'll start. I would say it's the lack of good science to show why this is good. I'd put it in the same kind of category as cupping. So we heard a lot about that at the Olympics last year, where all these Olympic athletes had these big welts on their backs and all over their body. And supposedly, like Michael Phelps, it's making him quicker. But there's no science behind it. It's just a random kind of little thing that seems like maybe it would feel good or could help. But there's nothing to show that it can enhance performance. And I say the same thing here, that it's just an expensive thing to do that probably wouldn't help a whole lot. There's no reason why the body would deal with things much better by going super, super cold. The one element that I think could help a little bit, but I'm still to see really good science to back this up, would be if you're alternating hot and cold. So, for example, at the local gym that I go to, it's called Recharge. It's all about recovery stuff. They have like a little cold pool and a hot pool. And you just spend a couple of minutes in each and you switch between them. And the idea being that it makes the blood flow change. So you're kind of just trying to flush things out, a little bit like massage. You're trying to kind of stop, start the blood a little bit to flush things out. And maybe there's a tiny benefit from that. But just from making it super cold and reducing inflammation, even things like an ice bath doesn't tend to be used as much anymore by athletes, because reducing inflammation, like Joe mentioned a minute ago, is not necessarily a good thing. Inflammation is not a bad thing in of itself. And typically, also, if you do reduce the inflammation and maybe you feel a little bit less sore immediately afterwards, it can have the detrimental effect of slowing your recovery. So the one time I'd say that's really useful is if you're doing a multi-day stage race, so you have to feel good next morning. But if you're doing normal training, you want to recover as quickly as possible, and so it's probably not the ideal thing to do.
Joe, any thoughts on cryotherapy?
Well, my profession of physical therapy is, for better or worse, known historically to be the profession of, you know, hot pads and cold packs. But we've also done a good job of researching this, and really overwhelmingly, especially for subacute to chronic injury, there's just no evidence that even icing a localized injury is significantly beneficial versus not. So anything, going back to what Ian said, you know, there's this idea of, okay, well, I want to improve performance by adding something. Well, anytime you add something, you're adding complexity to a system. So cryotherapy may have some benefits, but what's the cost of having to drive a half hour to the cryotherapy location versus just relaxing at home? So I a lot of this stuff, I think, even going to like a recovery lounge like Ian described, any time where you can relax and just do something enjoyable, that's the ultimate placebo against any of these things. If you had a study that said, let's compare, you know, this kind of medical grade cryotherapy versus laying down in a cold stream, possibly with a beer next to you, and compare those two things in terms of your overall recovery, performance, any other measure, I think the cold stream and the beer would come out potentially just as well. Without the cost, without having to drive someplace. So for that in particular, that's what makes me go thumbs down. There's just not enough evidence. There's too much to say that it's not useful. And then anything that's going to cost you more money and make you drive somewhere just doesn't seem to be a net gain.
So Matt. I want to both agree and then disagree with Joe at the same time.
Oh, good.
I completely agree. I mean, there's actually more evidence that says icing and cryotherapy does damage and prevents the adaptations that you're looking for. Yep. So there's plenty of studies now coming out that shows, at least with muscle hypertrophy, so getting larger muscles, adapting to resistance training, people who ice have less of that. So they don't get as big a response when they go into cold baths afterwards. And then the opposite, I would say, well, okay, maybe relaxing is the best, but I would actually say doing the opposite, doing sauna training is probably beneficial. There's a ton of really interesting evidence. I know this is not the topic that we were talking about, but it's sort of...
Keep going. I'm interested.
The opposite of the cryotherapy, that sauna training is almost like exercise training, and it stimulates a lot of the same adaptations. It stimulates an increase in plasma volume, an improvement in insulin sensitivity, improvement in muscle hypertrophy, effects on the brains, on the brain. So there's a lot of beneficial effects of heat training through sauna training that I think you'd be much better time spent there than in sort of a cryotherapy situation.
And if I could submit this comment, you know, the body gets things right all the time on its own without our interference. And how come we think that we need to limit inflammation? The body's kind of figured a lot of things out, like heart rate and pH level and you name it. It's right on the mark. So what is it that we think that we've got to control this inflammation? It's out of control. The body can't figure out how to manage itself. I've got to put a little more faith in the body's system. Scott, you were about to say something.
I'm just stuck on Matt's little tangent there about sauna training. So you're telling me that sauna training, it goes far beyond benefiting you than just heat training for like Western states.
Yeah, there's some really cool studies showing that the induction of these proteins are called heat shock proteins. And so, yeah, they're sort of induced during sauna training, but they have all sorts of beneficial effects at the sort of cellular level and even at sort of more physiological studies as well. I mean, they've done studies where they've taken people, just given them sauna training, and then before and after the sauna training, look at their exercise performance, and they've seen benefits in exercise performance. Now, these aren't well-trained athletes. These are probably just people coming off the couch. So any adaptation is going to benefit them. But still, I think it speaks to some of the interesting adaptations of sauna training. And I just emailed my doctor today to say, how soon can I get in the sauna with these stupid steri strips on my knee, you know, pulling my wound together so I can prevent the, you know, atrophy that's occurring to my leg as I have to sit up and leave it sitting there. So,
and guys, I don't have the answer to this. Maybe you guys can weigh in on it, but Scott mentioned negative 220 degrees Fahrenheit. Our lung tissues are pretty delicate. And I couldn't imagine getting into that kind of cold because we weren't built for that and breathing that into our lungs. And I don't know if they put a mask on you or what they do. And I don't know how much that could superheat that.
Is it not just below the neck, like your head's out the top, I thought? So your lungs, you wouldn't be breathing in cold air?
Yeah, your head's above the sort of barrel.
Well, par for the course. I'm off by about 180 degrees on any comment. So thumbs down for my comments. So let's give comments, wrap it around here. What do we think about cryotherapy?
Let's start with Joe.
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Ian, no change?
Thumbs down. Yeah, I think that just it kind of theme through all of these and the last time that we were speaking as well is that we're trying to get these very marginal extra gains. And ultimately, if you want to get big gains, the two biggest things that are going to improve your fitness are training itself. So doing some training and rather than not doing some training, that's the biggest one, and sleep for recovery. So rather than spending half an hour spending $200 to go into something, get half an hour extra sleep, and that's probably going to have a bigger effect.
And I'll throw in nutrition, good eating the right foods.
Yeah.
I'd say it a trifecta.
Hey, now your thumbs down. Oh,
no, Matt, we didn't get Matt's.
Oh, Matt?
I'm sure Matt's still thumbs down.
I'm definitely a thumbs down.
Don?
I'm thumbs down. I'm not going against these brilliant minds.
Well, I am a contradictorian.
Yeah.
Is that a word?
It is now.
But I'm not on this one. I'm also a thumbs down.
Hey, I have a question for you guys.
I moved to California for a reason from Wyoming.
Some of these guys that are doing heat training, you brought that up, getting in a sauna, and Scott brought up a race to prepare for. What do you guys think about runners going out and on a hot day and putting sweats on, a jacket on, a knit hat and gloves and running out in the heat as a way to adapt to heat? Advise runners to do that or not to do that? What are your thoughts?
I totally do. I do that for Western states because especially if it's not super, super hot, but you're just trying to get more of a heat benefit. And you're trying to, as with any training adaptation, you're trying to force the body to get a little bit uncomfortable, a little bit beyond what it can currently do, so that there's a stimulus that it can adapt to. So that's exactly the aim there.
Yeah,
awesome.
Anything that increases the body's core temperature will have the same effects as the sauna training or sort of any heat adaptation protocol that you should be employing before your ultra, especially if it's in a warm climate.
So roll up the windows and turn on the heater. Joe?
What I'll add is you just have to be careful with that. I think that, and I've done that, and that is a classic Oregon Western States preparation strategy is to, I've got a friend who's got a Tyvek suit, like for painting, that he wears around, and I mean, it breathes nothing. And it's, while it is humorous, you have to be careful of heart rate, because you could do 8 minute pace in the Tyvek suit, but have your heart rate spike to 170 because you're just boiling. So there needs to be a recognition that if you're doing an active based heat training, that there's going to be a metabolic cost associated with that effort. So as long as you're kind of counting that as a workout, I think that you're going to be okay. But there needs to be that recognition, especially for runners who are heat training a week out or 2 weeks out from a 100-miler when they should be resting and they're going on these active heat runs.
Well, and to add to that, that's why I ask for people to, and this is what I do myself, to start heat training maybe 3 to 4 weeks out from the race and stop about a week out, because it is a huge effort on the body. So even running or even hiking slowly is very exhausting. So it might be like doing a speed workout. So that exhausts the body. And again, maybe things like this Whoop device could show you how much more it's taken out of you, but you'll feel it anyway, how tired you are. And the first few sessions in particular, you'll really notice. So yeah, there's definitely that caveat. That also is a bit more dangerous. You know, if you go out on a trail in the middle of nowhere and then you pass out because you're so hot, there is danger there. So you always want to let people know where you're going on any trail, but especially if you're going to add in any extra difficulties like this.
Hey, good add to that, Ian, on stopping heat training a week before, because it really puts a demand on the body. I think that's a good golden nugget right there. We have one last topic, and we'll make it fairly quick, and it's on foam rolling. You know, foam rollers all over the place, and you can go online and look them up, and they'll have every different type of shape and design you can imagine, but it's creating some friction right on the skin. Thumbs up or thumbs down, guys, on foam rolling, and then we'll hear a short discussion.
How about Matt? Up or down?
I'm a thumbs up.
Thumbs up from Matt. Ian?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up.
And from our physical therapist, Joe.
Thumbs up.
Ooh, that should be a short discussion.
Freeman, you're in the medical field.
I don't get to vote yet.
Oh, that's right. Dang.
Haven't you got this down pat, Scott?
It takes me a while.
Okay, let's hear from Joe, our physical therapist, our resident foam rolling expert, I would say.
I actually have an article coming out in Trail Runner magazine in October, I think. September, October, that just talks about foam rolling or tissue mobility in general. And it's important to kind of differentiate what you're trying to do with foam rolling, and to conceptualize what it kind of looks like, what tissues look like under the skin, is you have, it's like sausages amongst sausages and then more sausages in terms of having muscle tissue surrounded by fascia. So if you were to just take a quad muscle and be able to look inside, or a thigh, you would see just off the top, very generally, you'd see four quadricep muscles in close proximity. Within that main muscle, those are surrounded by fascia, and fascia is this, it's semi-contractile. Most people think it's a passive tissue, but there's a little bit of contractility to it. But it looks like a sausage casing. It's thin and it's white and it's tough, and it separates one muscle from the other. And then even within that, there are subgroups of muscle fibers also coated by these coverings. And the idea is they're all supposed to slide and glide amongst one another. Well, the issue with either fascia surrounding an individual muscle, or fascia that may connect, let's say, your thigh to your hip to your trunk, is that over the course of activity, and especially vigorous activity, these fascial connections can become rigid. And this flexible, almost fluid fascia can become stiff, rigid, inelastic, almost plastic material. So the idea behind myofascial release, or what's called myofascial manipulation, or the aims of foam rolling, primarily is to make sure that all of those groups of muscles can kind of slide and glide on their own. So whether that's foam rolling or the two roller blades stuck together, which is the roll recovery, where it's kind of, you know, two rollers, or there's the stick, which has, you know, it's just this combination of pressure with some gradient of, you know, motion. The idea, the primary benefit, is to get those separate muscle tissues that are supposed to be free moving, because the consequence to those not moving is you're going to lose functional mobility. You may not be able to lift your hip as high in front of you or push it as far behind. And that's the real performance detriment. So I'm wholeheartedly thumbs up for that.
So do you recommend foam rolling before, during, or after a workout?
So based on that theory, I'm a bigger proponent of doing a light amount of foam rolling before activity. And again, I had this 5-part mobility series and I Run Far and had a lot of discussion and debate about the research behind stretching. And it's important, you have to differentiate between, okay, are you stretching within the muscle? So like, are you stretching the meat of the sausage, or are you stretching one casing versus the other casing? Or around a joint, for example. So in that analogy, or what I'm talking about with fascial mobility, you want that fascia to move in its normal range of motion before you go run. Otherwise, it's like being bound down with shrink wrap, which is kind of what running at the day after an ultra or after a long run can feel like. And if you continue to train with progressively tighter systems, you're going to lose range of motion. And if you lose range of motion, you're going to lose power, you're going to lose endurance, and you could hurt yourself.
Ian, what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. All the same stuff. And I'd put massage in or sports massage in particular, in the same bucket, where it's the same aims that you're trying to achieve. It can just get a little bit deeper. And sometimes it's easier to have someone else hurting you than doing it to yourself with a foam roller. But the aim is basically, if you lose range of motion, then firstly, you're going to lose a bit of efficiency. So you may not be running as well on that workout. But equally, it's one of the biggest causes, I would say, of running injuries, is that we get a bit of tightness that builds up a little bit more. It restricts how your body's moving. And then maybe because the feet are landing differently, there may be more strain on the knees or other areas, and that leads to injuries. And this is for the entire body. This isn't just talking lower half. If you have tightness in the top half of your body, that's also going to affect your biomechanics. So anything there that is causing more strain and meaning that your running stride is a little bit different. I mean, this is Joe's complete area of expertise, but at a high level, what I'm saying here is that you're more likely to get injured if you don't foam roll or get massage, because you're more likely to build up little imbalances in the tightness that affects how your feet are landing. And if you're doing that tens of thousands of times, you can pick up injuries.
Matt, question for you. So it sounds like there's huge benefits in this foam rolling stuff. Do you advocate foam rolling to people you talk with? And how frequently? Daily, weekly, monthly?
Many of the athletes I coach have at least 2 dedicated foam roll sessions a week, where they're spending a solid 20, 30 minutes on the foam roller as part of their active recovery. And I call it sort of a self-care day. Again, it's that stress plus rest equals growth equation. I definitely have it written in to people's training programs. And I think Joe described the sort of fascia very nicely. And the other thing that's sliding with among those sausages is the nerves. And if you don't release the muscles from the nerves, I know from sort of firsthand hamstring experience that you can get tight and painful sort of muscles, or just sort of pain in general that's very diffuse and you're not even sure where it's coming from. And that can often just because the nerve is being caught up on some of this fascia or something like that.
And I'll shamelessly plug and say that I just published an article on I Run Far yesterday on nerve pain as part of running injuries, and how you kind of differentiate between what Matt was talking about, a neurogenic pain versus not, because he's exactly right. The mobility of the system, it doesn't just include muscles and tendons, but there are blood vessels and nerves, and everything has to have some room to slide and glide. And when you lose that, you can lose range of motion, you can overstress a muscle, but then you can compress or otherwise irritate a nerve as well.
And if you lose mobility in a muscle and you're forcing that gait The gait may be either shortened, which could cause new biomechanical problems, or you load another part of the system more that would have been naturally used by the or making provided by that muscle that's tight. So balance is good and function is good, and what we do sometimes leads to some dysfunction. So finding someone that knows how to work on you and getting some good instruction on a foam roller, I think, is good. Somebody just buying a foam roller and going to town on it could be detrimental. Trauma doesn't always necessarily help trauma, but having some good advice on how to use it is important. Joe, you're about to say something, I think.
Yeah, so with the friction I ran into in my performance mobility series and I Run Far was there is a significant body of research. When I introduced this idea of, okay, well, you have to stretch, this is what you need to stretch. Well, people came back, they said, well, whoa, you know, there's this study that says if you stretch the calf muscle or you stretch the hip prior to exercise, you lose peak power and endurance and all of these things. And to keep going back to the crude sausage analogy, the studies that they're referring to is the meat or tissue extensibility of an individual muscle. So you don't want to overstretch and stretch and stretch the gastrocnemius muscle. You just want to ensure that the gastroc with the soleus and the Achilles and all of the other underlying things around the ankle and the knee all just move their share, and then you're good. And it's the same thing with foam rolling. You want to do enough where things are moving. So for my high school kids this spring, we would have two dedicated kind of self-care afternoons, and we would just, you know, take 2, 3, 4 minutes per muscle group, and you're constantly rolling and moving, and you're never really mashing on one individual muscle over and over again. You're just touching on these systems and just making sure that they move.
Good, good.
I think it's voting time.
Voting time.
Everybody all at once, instead of going one by one, everybody, this is the audible podcast, but we're gonna describe what's happening. Everybody on the count of three, thumbs up or thumbs down. 1, 2, 3.
Thumbs up across the board.
Everybody had thumbs up. I have to tell you that this is one that has motivated me. I don't foam roll. I don't know whether, I think I have one time when I had some hip mobility issues, and I did it for maybe a month, and that's it.
You know, by the time you're done with all of these things, you're going to put your Whoop on, you're going to get your Cryo going and your foam roll. You'll be running up front with Ian Sharman next season.
Hey guys, thanks for your time. We appreciate your wisdom and knowledge on this podcast. I absolutely learned some things. There's some things that have motivated me a little bit to become a better runner this last hour.
So, guys, thanks a lot. We can find these coaches at their respective websites, et cetera.
Which will be linked in the show notes.
And if you're not reading show notes, Scott, I see you trying to drive people to your show notes. Ian, where do we find you? And let's go around the horn here for those that are just listening without pens and paper. Ian.
ShamanUltra.com. So Shaman, Sharman. Or all social media, Sharman Ian, very easy.
Fine. Hey, Matt, how about you?
Layingitdown.wordpress.com or contact me on Twitter at MJLay, it's LAYE.
Or go to his class and go to what, University of Idaho, enroll?
College of Idaho.
College of Idaho, of course. Freeman. I'm sorry.
Premier liberal arts school in Idaho.
Nice plug. The home of the what? The Bobcats or the Wildcats or who?
We had the Coyotes.
Of course, the Coyotes. What else would you be? And how about you, Joe?
you can find me at yuhanperformance.com.
Nice. Gentlemen, without you guys, we would have had a show of nothing, of incorrect statements, and we're happy to be guided in the right direction from you.
Matt, we wish you a fast recovery. Ian, we wish you a fast finish.
At Leadville?
Leadville.
And Joe, fast at whatever's coming up for you, too.
Could be Rio del Lago down your guys' way.
Right on. I'll get to see you there. I'll either be announcing or find my way into that run. That sounds fantastic.
Right.
Good, Joe. Look forward to seeing you. So go out and run.
Mas.
Hey, guys, thanks. As always, a really spirited conversation. Thumbs up to the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It's always fun.
Thank you. Yeah. But we seem to be in agreement in general, though Matt likes to have it both ways a lot of the time.
Yeah, he's kind of sideways on his thumb.
He's in a liberal college up in Idaho. Well, you gotta keep it. Give that to him.
Yeah. What were you just gonna say, Scott?
Do we want to do it this week?
No, I think we have part two of UTMB coming up with Jason Schlarb and Mayo Sinek, and then we will release this one.
So next week.
Yeah, a week following.
We'll send you the link to the podcast when we get it.
Right on. Okay. Please thanks, guys. Right, thanks for your time.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.